Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Hope you had a good Labor Day weekend. Nice to have you back with us for the rest of the week, 10 to noon here on 89.3. And if you ever miss Air Talk, but you want to check in on any of the segments that we do, they are available for you anytime, day or night, via the KPECC app or at kpecc.org. Later this hour, we'll talk with the president of the Huntington Library Art Collections and Botanical Gardens. The Huntington is celebrating its centennial. A whole year's worth of events kick off this week. We'll talk about what's in store and also about the historic evolution of the Huntington over the course of this century. That's all to come later this hour. But we begin with politics and the very latest news on that front with Republican political analyst Sean T. Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, former advisor to California Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and former White House staffer for Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Also with us, president of Way to Win, a national donor and organization network working for progressive causes, Tori Gavito. Good to have you both with us today. So we've got 10 candidates who will be taking part in the next Democratic presidential debate. They are former VP Joe Biden, who is the current front runner in the race, according to polls. Also, Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts Senator, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, California U.S. Senator, Amy Klobuchar, Minnesota U.S. Senator, Beto O'Rourke of Texas, Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, former Housing Secretary Julian Castro, and finally Andrew Yang, a tech entrepreneur from California. Tori, let me start with you, and we welcome you. Good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
What happens to all these other candidates who have not dropped out, a la New York's Kirsten Gillibrand, are still campaigning but didn't qualify for the debate?
Well, you know, I've really got to give it to Gillibrand for being having the character to call it. What she's doing is allowing her her donors and her followers to put that precious time and money behind other candidates, and even moving resources down ballot in places across the states where we have the potential to not only hold new pickups from 2018 in Congress, but expand the electorate. So I think more candidates need to follow her lead and make sure that they're doing what's right for the party. And it would be hard, I think, at this point to build any sort of traction after not getting on that debate stage come Iowa.
The debate, by the way, will be next week, Thursday night, September 12th, 5 o'clock Pacific until 8 p.m. Pacific time. ABC and Univision will be broadcasting the debate. Sean, your thoughts about those that are staying in the race but not in the debate. What's the upside for them?
Cabinet positions.
Okay. So by staying in longer, does that really keep their profile alive more? Or is anybody going to be paying attention since they're not on the debate stage?
Well, you get a different kind of candidate. So some of the smaller candidates have smaller campaigns. They can stay in the race a lot longer. And once you're vested in running for an office, it's awful hard to put it down. So, but right now, what's happening is what, you know, was expected to happen. The field, the pack is getting winnowed down to probably five candidates, Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris, and Buttigieg. And Buttigieg and Harris are really, you know, they're being lapped by the top three contenders. So, I mean, this is a natural state of evolution. Eventually, these folks will start to fall off. And there's motivations, both ego-wise as well as long-term political motivations, why people stay in the races longer.
Given this is 10 candidates again, I wonder what effect that's going to be on people paying attention, Sean, because, you know, one of the downsides, even with the back-to-back nights of debates, the field's so big, it still seems it's hard, you know, to get the public attention until the field is winnowed. So you got a chicken and an egg phenomenon, because it's, you know, hard to get it winnowed until people do start paying attention.
Well, there's that, Larry, but there's another dynamic as well. So The one thing about having a larger segment of the debate floor is you get different kinds of questions and different kinds of policy issues raised. If you look at Sanders and Warren, I mean, they almost are two sides of the same coin on many of their policy issues. Harris also is pretty left and trying to run hard left. Biden, you know, he's still trying to run as the centrist. But, you know, Mr. Yang brings up some interesting points. So does Mr. Buttigieg. So does Mr. Booker. So, I mean, they add different dynamics to the debate. Inslee's gone, and he added something interesting, I think, on climate change and being a governor from a Western state. But, you know, I do like the fact that you're not getting one monolithic message when you have a larger audience or larger candidate pool.
Tori Gavito, do you think it's going to be tough to get people tuning into this debate, you know, given the size of the field on stage?
Well, certainly as you're reading the list of the 10 candidates that made it, I was thinking, wow, he needs the breath control of Lizzo to be able to pull off that list. But I think, you know, what I think is going to happen is we are going to see a range of debate. I think it's wrong for us to continue to think that there's a left or a right or a center, when really what we're seeing right now in America with wealth inequality the way it is, that there's a top and a bottom. And the candidates on that stage have got to make a case for how they're going to solve people's problems, that how they're going to help people really get ahead. Wall Street Journal came out with a report about a week ago that that bottom half of the United States, income earners in the United States, their wealth has diminished by about 30% since 2003. This is not a sustainable economic environment, and people need to show they have plans.
I wonder, Tori, about the fact that Joe Biden has pretty much had the moderate part of the field to himself. And are you surprised that there aren't more candidates that have tried to go after that, given how important the moderate sector is to the Democratic Party when it comes to turnout?
Well, again, I reject this premise that there's a moderate section versus a more left. I think that people are looking for solutions. Earlier today, I heard a headline that Biden said he's running basically to defeat Trump. And in my point of view, that's reminding people that they're on the Titanic without pointing where the lifeboats are. I think that people like Elizabeth Warren, who have articulated plans about how they're going to solve folks' problems, are the ones that are going to get and continue to get traction.
I guess I'm wondering, for Democrats who aren't necessarily sold on single payer, who are concerned about higher taxes, who are concerned about, you know, power of unions, that sort of thing, you know, where is their place to go going to be within the party?
Well, I think that the party, the front runners in the party right now, Biden, Warren, Sanders, I mean, I think that they've made clear that they are running for working people. And it's those candidates who can actually articulate who the working people are that I think will stand the best chance. And when I say that, I mean, there tends to be a race blindness when we talk about the working class in America. But by my account, we've got working people across this country who are Black, who are Latino, who are AAPI. And so I think it's those candidates who can really speak to a modern economy that works for everyone, regardless of whether you're in an urban center, a suburban center, or in the rural places in America, regardless if you're white or if you're brown. Those are the ones that are going to capture attention. Certainly Elizabeth Warren is doing that.
I was looking at the piece that was written by Zogby, who runs the Zogby poll. It was an op-ed piece, and he was laying out his concerns. He's a Democrat, because he said, you know, historically, the moderates in the Democratic Party have really been the ones to turn out, and Biden is kind of their only place to go. And Sean, do you think that that is potentially a problem, that moderate Democrats, if it's a progressive who ends up being nominated, that they could end up staying home?
I do. People forget that people rejected the mainline Republican Party platform in the last presidential election and went with a guy, Donald Trump, who campaigned basically as a populist. a campaign saying he was going to bring jobs back to working Americans in the Rust Belt and other parts of the country. So, you know, with our other guest here, whether you agree with him or not, and people are going to guffaw, that is the type of message that Donald Trump campaigned on the last time out. Now, this time out, his right track, wrong track is down over 21%. So it's 35 to 57. His unfavorables are, you know, 12 plus percentage points. So he's got a lot of real problems here. And if the economy does slow down, he's in real trouble. And, you know, I've done this for a long time and I look at focus groups and polling. And I think that the reason why Democrats took back the House of Representatives is because they were able to hold their base with their various constituency groups, but they took middle class and upper middle class, largely white women in the suburbs, and had them angry enough at Donald Trump to turn the tide. So if you alienate that particular base, it's the swing vote that wins elections. It's generally not the base. You got to get the base out, but swing votes count. And so if you alienate that, I think Donald Trump has a fighting chance of being reelected.
Tori Gavita, I'm curious your thoughts on that, because the reason I thought it would be virtually impossible for Donald Trump to have been elected back in 2016 was I didn't think he could win white women. He did very narrowly, but as you look at you know, where those numbers are now, you think that that's really going to be the you know, key demographic that decides this?
So I think where we have agreement on this call right now about how Trump won is this focus on exploiting the fears of the working class. He pointed to two primary scapegoats. He pointed to immigrants in the United States driving down wages, and he pointed to foreign workers in China driving down wages. Well, here's the deal. He's one of the biggest flim-flam artists I've seen this century. He's saying, keep your eyes on the deck while I pick your pockets. And while that was his message in terms of focusing on the working class, he has not delivered. And what he's done is created he's not built a wall, for example, on the Mexican border, but he has built an opportunity for us to create multiracial coalitions. So I'm going to bring it back to California for a second. You know, we point to Prop 187. This was the xenophobic bill that Pete Wilson propped up that was the catalyst that moved California from red to blue. Trump has created that moment nationwide. In the state like Texas, where I'm calling you from today, we've got about 200,000 votes down from winning statewide this cycle. That's where we were able to move the electorate in 2018. We've got 4 million people of color concentrated in a handful of cities. We can fill this gap, and it's going to get done not just by focusing on white, suburban, swing voters, but by actually expanding the electorate. And that's how we win.
But that's, yeah, and obviously that's the goal. But just historically, the evidence hasn't been there that you can turn out enough of those you know, along if you lose the moderate. So that may be true, but wouldn't that be a historic shift?
Well, historically, the Democratic candidate hasn't won the white vote in 30 years. We look with it, you know, we've got Barack Obama. He barely busted 40% of the white vote. What historically has won elections is by having the black electorate enthusiastic, by having Latino voters turn out, by having young people excited. And that's what I'm looking for in the standard bearers this cycle.
Of course, the other issue is the cultural appeal that Trump had beyond the economics, because I think one of the things that supporters of Trump turn to is that they prefer his positions on cultural issues. They're very happy about his Supreme Court justices that he nominated. They're very happy about the tax cut. And Sean, so in that sense, he's given Republicans, you know, successes during the course of his tenure. But at the same time, so many Republicans seem to be upset about what a divisive figure he is.
Well, look, he's his own best friend and he's his own worst enemy. So some of the positions he takes, Republicans really don't like. He is, you know, hell-bent on trying to take most of the troops, if not all of the troops, out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq, which is historically a pretty classic Democrat foreign policy position. He talks in a populist perspective. The labor unions historically actually are favorable towards trade sanctions and protectionism, and he does that. So I don't know if there's a dog whistle or a little underlying underlying message where Democrats, moderate Democrats, see this as being something favorable. But I think he does message to moderate to conservative Democrats. With regards to the comment about, you know, how Democrats win elections, again, it's almost always the swing voters that you have to get your base and be fairly solid, but it's swing voters that actually win elections. And you are going to have moderate to conservative Democrats come back over to whomever the Democratic candidate is. And Biden is probably the most favorable, both in the first choice on the ballot and the second choice on the ballot. And then the second issue I think is going to happen is that they're going to have to convince people that Trump's comments, his tweets, and some of his erratic behavior is just too problematic long term for the country. And if the economy still rock solid, and say, look, the guy's done okay on the economy. We don't think it's really his credit, but you know, he's got to go because he's just too much of a risk. And so if they can make that case, and then lastly, that you know, underrepresented minority voters have to turn out. And historically, I mean, a lot of Democrats, when I go on these programs, don't like to hear this, but historically, their numbers don't come out in as high as white older voters do. So if they can get a get out the vote effort like a lot of labor unions do around the country, they can do well and succeed. And if they don't get a motivated voter turnout, then they generally have problems.
Well, and Barack Obama was a transformational candidate who was able to light that fire. The question is, whomever the Democrats nominate, is that person going to be able to light that fire? Or is there just going to be so much anti-Trump sentiment that whoever the nominee is, they're going to get a kind of reverse energized because of antipathy toward Trump? We're talking with Republican political analyst Sean Walsh, president of Way to Win, Tori Gavito, a national organization that works for progressive causes. We'll continue our politics conversation in just 1 minute. Dare Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up just a little bit later this hour, the president of the Huntington Library Art Collections and Botanical Gardens in San Marino, Karen Lawrence, will be joining us. We'll be talking with her about the kickoff of the centennial events at the Huntington. Last Friday was the date that the trust was created 100 years ago by the Huntingtons to turn over their property for public visitation. The Huntington operates both with this, you know, public space where people come every day to tour the gardens and the galleries, the library. And it's also a place where scholars come from around the world to go into those stacks, the holdings of the Huntington, and to conduct their studies. So we'll talk about that coming up shortly. Right now, it's politics we're focused on with Tori Gavito of Way to Win, progressive organization, and Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, as we talk about where things stand for the 2020 presidential race. Tori, your thoughts about the appeal of the different candidates. So as we look at polls, it seems like Bernie Sanders has had a difficult time expanding his support as Elizabeth Warren's support has grown. And I wonder your thoughts about that. It is part of this, perhaps, that Warren is really tapping into support from Democratic women in a way that Sanders has struggled with.
Yeah, I think that Bernie Sanders, you know, the people that go are fans of Bernie Sanders have created a church. They're the church of Bernie Sanders. And it's really hard to settle yourself into a church as a new member. You know, you don't know the customs and the norms. And that's how it feels in his squad. Now, Elizabeth came out strong. I remember her breakout moment was in Houston for the She the People event, where she was speaking to women of color, organizers, activists, operatives, and she connected to everyone. She was the first candidate in that room that got a standing ovation, and she has not stopped since. And she has room to grow. So, you know, she is talking to not just the people of color and activists and young people, but she's also talking to suburban moms of all stripes. And so I think she's got a lot of room to grow. And what we do at Way to Win is listen to where the people are moving. We want to fuel mass movements. And it seems like she's got her ear on the ground like we do.
Well, and I wonder, too, about the sort of, for lack of a better term, charisma. I mean, one of the challenges that Hillary Clinton had was very high negatives coming into that race. And the comparison with Barack Obama, who was a charismatic candidate. And do you see in Elizabeth Warren, and maybe unfair to compare her to Barack Obama because he's one of the truly gifted speakers ever in national politics, but do you think that, you know, Warren, as you mentioned, with this upside, that she has that ability to personally connect?
I think politics is part math and part imagination. And the math, you have to know, you know, who's your base, who's going to turn out come hell or high water on election day. And you have to add to that number because, as from what I can tell, Trump, that's Trump's playbook. So I've been poring over Brad Parscale, Trump's campaign manager's Twitter feed, all publicly available information about his campaign. What I can tell is they aren't just talking to the middle. They're racing for a new electorate on the right. They're pouring in voters who are extreme white supremacists who haven't voted before. And so what we should be looking for is, how do we keep up that race? How do we keep pouring people into our base at a scale and speed that is greater than the Republicans, you know, poking holes in the bottom of our bucket with voter suppression and other dirty tactics? And I think that with that math and that magic, there are a number of candidates who can turn that on. I think Elizabeth Warren is among them.
We're talking with Tori Gavito, president of Way to Win. Sean, you know, your thoughts about it. I can't believe there are enough white supremacists to make that much of a difference in a national election. But your thoughts about how Tori characterized who the president's trying to turn out.
Well, she figured out the secret message. It's the white supremacist vote. I just think that's silly. So, I mean, the bottom line in this current environment, I think it's going to go back to a little bit of what Bill Clinton campaigned on. It's the economy stupid. And so the economy is doing great. And if people have faith that Donald Trump can continue the economy going well, even with all his ridiculous tweets, because unemployment is at record low for Latinos, it's at record low for African-Americans, and people are doing fairly well. If he can convince people there that they will continue to do well, I think he's got a good chance, even with his really high negatives and his right track, wrong track issue. But it's, you know, 5 months between now and Iowa, and there's a long way to go. You know, the market's had some hiccups. China can, I think, impact the market and manipulate it a little bit. So he's got to, you know, walk that tight wire. So, it, you know, as I say, it's a long way to go. So I just literally think that the country is not populated with racists in Michigan and Iowa and New Hampshire and every other Rust Belt state. I just think people vote on what they think is in their interest and their kids' interest and their grandkids' interest. And so are the Democrats going to be able to say, this guy is just so terrible and he's going to lead us down the path of ruin, so let's try someone new? And when it goes to Elizabeth Warren, the one thing that I will tell you that I've been very impressed by her is she is a college professor, and she does have the ability to explain fairly complex issues in fairly digestible and easily to understand ways. So I think if she actually moderates, does the Nixon maxim, which is run to the left in the primary and moderate a little bit in the general election, she's going to be a really, really tough candidate for Mr. Trump to run against.
One of the challenges, I think, is going to be fears for many voters that it's going to mean a tax increase if she or Sanders are elected. And so do you think that there are ways that if she were the nominee or Sanders was the nominee, that they could somehow speak to those concerns, Sean?
Well, I think if Sanders is the nominee, you know, he's going to run as just the wild, you know, crazy guy with his hair kind of on fire, and he's just too extreme and too radical. Now, Warren's policies may be as liberal or even more liberal than Bernie Sanders' policies, but she presents a presence, and she articulates it in a way that I think some people can say, all right, I'm willing to take a leap of faith or do the benefit of the doubt and back her up. Biden still really is the, you know, safety valve. But, you know, the Democrats are kind of poo-pooing or dismissing his, you know, mashup of the, you know, war veteran story that came out. But Joe does that a lot. And I think at some juncture, people are going to get tired of the kind old Uncle Joe who stumbles over stories and mashes things together. And they're going to wonder, A, with his age, and B, with his constitution, does he have what it takes to run head-to-head with Donald Trump? And I do think you're going to get, you know, a Gerald Ford kind of problem with Joe Biden if he has any, you know, many more of these malaprops going in to the rest of the election.
We're talking with Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, Tori Guvito, president of Way to Win, which is a national progressive movement, donor and organizing network. We're talking about where things stand on the political developments of the past week or so. Tori, your thoughts about candidates beyond Joe Biden being able to turn out the African-American vote, because that's where Biden continues to be so strong. Can Elizabeth Warren, can Bernie Sanders connect more substantially with African-American voters?
Well, let me take a quick step back to this comment about it's about the economy, you know, comma stupid. If that were true, then I just don't see why Trump would spend any time attacking birthright citizenship and, you know, engaged in continued trade wars with China, which are going to increase family budgets on a yearly basis. I think that if it were really about the economy, he would be focusing more on some of those bread and butter issues. What we are looking at is a highly divided, polarized time where a demagogue is in power who is scapegoating people of color and foreign workers for America's problems. And in terms of, you know, now getting to your question about the black vote, I mean, I think that the way we slice and dice the white vote, from white suburban women to, you know, soccer moms, we have to understand the black vote is not a monolithic a block. You've got age diversity, you've got economic diversity, and you also have ideological diversity. But the mobilized vote right now, that I can tell, is the black groups that are mobilized behind a new movement, the Movement for Black Lives, for example. And they're looking for real solutions that are going to not just address increased violence, police violence, but also address these economic situations that are keeping communities divided.
It's interesting because what I keep reading is that looking again, you know, on average and median positions, that African-American voters are not as progressive as many of the candidates in the race. Sean, your thoughts about that, and if that is going to be a challenge beyond Biden as a candidate?
I think that's probably right. I'm not sure that an African-American in Tennessee or an African-American in Arizona, you know, is as in love with Bernie Sanders as some of the Democratic, you know, Birkenstock wearing New Hampshire, Vermont liberal activists are. So I agree with my colleague here that the Democratic vote, and particularly the African-American vote, is not monolithic. And so I think sometimes the messages that Bernie Sanders has, they take for granted that African-Americans are simply going to go along with that type of messaging and that type of policy. And I'm not entirely sure they will.
Hey, before I let you both go, you know, trade dispute with China, the new tariffs going into effect. Sean, your thoughts on what that's going to potentially mean politically?
Well, so I'm a classic, boring, old school Republican, and I'm generally a free trader, lower taxes, less regulation. I think that Donald Trump has actually delivered on a lot of those underlying messages that Republicans like. With regards to trade issues, and I, in full disclosure, I've got some Chinese clients and others that are impacted by this trade dispute issues. But, you know, at some juncture, are you going to draw the line with China and call them out when they're cheating? And they cheat repeatedly and often. And so at some juncture, somebody has to stand up to them and say no. Politically speaking, though, you know, that's a real risk for President Trump. And more significantly, it's probably a real risk for the Republicans who are running for re-election in the Senate in this next election cycle. There are 25 of them that are up for re-election. And a lot of these states are in more conservative farm belt states. So, you know, it's not going to take a lot of votes for people to be unhappy saying that, you know, I've lost 15% or 20% of my soybean exports or my corn exports to China or Asia. And so that could have a real political impact.
Tori Guvito, quick thought on that.
Well, I think we need to continue to ask the question, who do these policies benefit? Do they benefit the working people of America, or do they benefit corporations? And as we enter new trade agreements, you know, looking at, for example, Beto O'Rourke's plan, many other trade plans among the Democratic contenders at this moment, what we see is a run to level the playing field, to make it less attractive for corporations to go abroad and exploit foreign labor, and that will raise conditions for all workers, including
certainly,
here at home.
And certainly President Trump has not made corporations happy with his tariffs on China. That's put him sideways with many of them. Troy Gavito of Way to Win, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, thank you both for being with us. We'll be back with more on Air Talk after this live update from Libby Denkman.